The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for joining us on the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources and podcasts. And do register there for a chance to win a free book. That's premierunbelievable.com. And if you are on Instagram or TikTok, please do check us out at premierunbelievable. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast, then please do consider rating and reviewing it on your podcast platform so that more people can hear about it. But now for today's show. In this episode, we're going to be hearing something a little bit different from normal. In November 2022, Ulster University hosted the first international academic C.S. Lewis symposium to be held in Northern Ireland. The event, called Now We Have Faces, was hosted by the C.S. Lewis group at Ulster University in coordination with English at Ulster, and they very kindly let us broadcast the talks on this podcast. What you are about to hear is the Q&A section following Malcolm's talk. If you missed part one and part two of his presentation, then do check out episodes 158 and 159.
Peter Kraft once said, with respect to C.S. Lewis as a literary writer, that it hasn't yet been fully appreciated or understood to what extent the accomplishment of translating Christ, as it were, into the figure of Aslan truly is. I wonder, in terms of embodiment and incarnation of a concept, of more than a concept, of logos, how do you think Lewis did in the figure of Aslan?
Well, that's a great question, and I think the first thing is to think about the way round he did it. I talked about that glance from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven. He was, I think, emphatically not writing a frigid allegory. I mean, he claimed, I think, rather in the teeth of the evidence, that he was ever being allegorical. I mean, I think there are, and Tolkien thought it was being too allegorical. But when Lewis is writing critically against allegory, he says, the problem with allegory is that it's just a kind of trick of the eye, really, that, you know, the person has proposition A, they translate it into allegory B, and then you can translate it back into proposition A, and proposition A is absolutely unaltered by its brief transit through the bodying forth of the allegorical story. That is, he emphatically thought, was a terrible way of writing, and he gives some examples in his scholarly book, The Allegory of Love, on how badly that could be done. However, what he contrasted with allegory in that sense, the task of, oh, how can I take the following five, you know, dogmatic propositions about Christ and translate them into something golden and furry, but it'll make no difference, you'll be back where you started, you know, when you've got the code. He was emphatically not doing that, and the books would have been appalling if he had done that. He was trying to write in what he called a mythopoetic way. And what he praised in Tolkien, I think he also wanted to try and achieve himself, where you write a story which is so open to symbolism that it's full of incipient allegories. But some of those are ones, and this is the test, that the author themselves learns from the act of writing. Now, Lewis says he'd started with the picture, the first thing that he had since he was a 16-year-old, he had a picture of a fawn walking through a snowy wood towards a lamppost. It was just like, what do I do with that? So in a sense, he was just trying to make sense of this pictorial image he'd been carrying since he was a teenager. But as he says in one of his letters, Aslan came bounding in and pulled the whole story together. So the arrival of Aslan was as much a surprise to Lewis, who'd already begun a Narnia story without him, as was the arrival of Strider in The Inn of the Prancing Pony. Tolkien said to the Inklings when he was reading that, that when Strider first appears, Tolkien said, I had no more idea who he was than Frodo did. He discovers, I mean, then the whole backstory of Strider pulls the whole story together. In both cases, they are a hidden king, both Aslan and Anya, and in both cases, they're in some sense a Christ figure, who appears without disclosing that that's who they are and demands their attention. So he refused to call it an allegory. What he said, he called The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe a supposal. Now, the supposal was, suppose there were another world quite different from ours, operating under different rules, this in this case, a kingdom of animals. Suppose the incarnation and the salvation, specifically the crucifixion and resurrection. Suppose they were to happen there, in that world, under that world's laws, in its own, what might that be like? Just as he makes a supposal in the Planetary Trilogy, supposing they know of the word of the Maleldale, you know, the great angel, supposing they don't know about the incarnation, that happened on the silent planet, they don't even know what, they know that God is going to do something with the silent planet, but they don't know what it is. And Ransom has the astonishing and humbling task of revealing that. It's a supposal. So I think Lewis almost certainly learned from his imaginative forming of Aslan a little bit more about Christ himself. I mean, the point he says, where he almost breaks the spell of the story, which I've given you as one of my passages, where he says, you are too old, children. You must begin to come close to your own world now. It isn't Narnia, you know, sobbed Lucy. It's you. We shan't meet you there. How can we ever meet you? But you shall meet me there, dear one. The very reason why you were brought to Narnia was that by knowing me here for a little, you know me, may know me better there. Now, knowing me here is the important thing. The knowing him in his Narnian terms will teach you better things, things you might not have known, had you only come to him in the other level. You see the difference? It's not packing something pre-digested into a cipher. It's learning from the storytelling itself a little more about the mystery that you began with.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Could you maybe say something about Lewis's use of the term baptized imagination?
Yes, sorry, was it's there's lots to say about that. So just to give everybody context, the place in which Lewis uses the term baptized imagination is in the passage in Surprised by Joy, where he's talking about his first reading of George MacDonald and how little he knew what was waiting for him when he picks up the dusty copy of secondhand copy of Phantastes from the railway bookstore and starts to read it on the train. And a lot of people gloss that word baptized as simply meaning given a quick Christian seal of approval, a kind of, you know, imprimatur. I don't think he means it. When he says baptized, he means death and resurrection. Baptism, you're baptized into the death of Christ, and then you rise up out of the waters into his risen life. Something has to die as well as rise in baptism. So he thinks that he crossed a border. Something that could have been entirely self-serving and corrosive in everybody's capacity for fantasy and imagination was challenged and died a little death by the holiness of MacDonald's imagination. He was opened up to the possibility of a redeemed imagination. It's not that he never then had the imagination of the old Adam, but he was shown what the imagination of the new Adam might be. So I think when you say baptized imagination, it's not just baptizing the imagination in some broad generic way, like saying, if you imagined it, it must be good. That's not the case. But saying that that the imagination, like every other faculty in us, must on the one hand die to self and on the other hand live to Christ. And that happens in some deep way before he knows its meaning. I think he also uses the word baptism because he's in a culture in which children are baptized or christened, and if you like, learn much later the meaning of the rite. But it's still an efficacious rite. I think Lewis believed that. So there's a sense in which, as a sheer mercy, something is given to him, some cleansing, some renewal, some repurposing of imagination is given in advance by the encounter with George MacDonald. And that shields him in some way from the worst of his Wagnerian excesses later on.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation.
About the link between reason and imagination, you've quoted Narnia and other such examples. How would you place the Pilgrim's Regress in your remarks about allegory and reason and so forth?
Well, of course, Pilgrim's Regress was his first effort writing after his conversion. And it's strongly influenced by the fact that he was working on the allegory of love. And obviously, Pilgrim's Regress is itself riffing on the title Pilgrim's Progress, and therefore he's looking to Bunyan. And it's a much more explicitly allegorical book than anything else he wrote. And in fact, he thought the allegory was a bit too obvious, but then his publishers said, people don't get this at all. And he had to write all those little explanations and running chapters at the beginning of it to explain that, you know, Mr. Neo-Angular is really, you know, high Anglicans like T.S. Eliot or whatever, you know. So I think most scholars would agree that it's probably, at an imaginative level, his least successful book. But least successful for Lewis is still way better than a lot of other books. And I think there's a huge amount to learn from it, both about Lewis's own progress and about our own journeys. I think his learning from the figure of history in that, his way of understanding medieval Christianity and the image of the lady, his rereading of the whole chivalric cult and culture is really good. When the book, the most powerful bit of the book is the Securo te Progesse bit, where he realizes in the end he's got to risk everything and he has to die. That's the baptism in that book. He has to dive right down and then swim under and come up on another side. And that involves complete letting go of all security. That realization that he could be intellectually posturing about the possible resonant coherence of Christianity to the end of his days and never be a Christian. You know, if he didn't finally, utterly let himself go into God with no promises of it working, just do it. It's an interesting biographical fact that in the summer that he was writing that book, he was learning to dive from, of all people, Owen Barfield, who was the very one who taught him to trust the imagination. And I think that's a bit where the allegory works incredibly well. But I think some of the other allegorical figures in that are too close to actually rather bitter Oxford satire than generous imaginative work. So that's the way I would be my take on that book.
But it's not more read.
Yeah, I mean, it's got a lot to teach. I would still commend it to anyone. And if you want a good, memorable, allegorical account of intellectual history since the Middle Ages, as it applies to Christianity, that's your book. And it does that incredibly well.
Thank you for your talk, Dr. Guy. Insofar as the scriptures tell us to love the Lord your God with all your mind, would you say that that's an invitation to an intellectual comprehension of God?
I think it's both. When it says love the Lord with all your God and all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, all your strength, that's clearly intended to be comprehensive. It's an instancing of some of the elements of the whole of you. But it says love the God with the whole of you. And I think probably all your mind means with your reason, and all your heart and all your soul is probably more correspondent to what we're talking about with all your imagination. But you give the whole thing to God. And therefore, every part of you, both your reason and your imagination, are capable of loving God. And I think in this case, capable of apprehending and comprehending God. And the purpose of the imagination, the poetic imagination, as your mind works on it in the act of loving God, is to woo apprehension into comprehension, and also to take the things you think you understand and comprehend and open them up to new apprehensions. And that's the work of a lifetime, and it's certainly the work of love. I think what's interesting about Jesus' quotation of that Old Testament commandment is that we rightly apply it to the use of our minds in knowing things, but only rightly because knowledge is or should be an aspect of love. The commandment is not to know, but to love. But what I think we've discovered is that there are certain things you can't know without loving first. You can't wait for you have to love first in order to know. Anybody, you know, who's been in a loving relationship, anybody who's in a marriage knows that the love comes first and the knowledge unfolds within the love. And it wouldn't be the same knowledge if the love wasn't there. I think one of the problems with academic and abstract theology is it tries to do things with the mind outside of love. And that's where it goes wrong.
I think we've got time for maybe one more question.
Yeah. I might round it up with a poem just for the fun of it.
Ah.
Right, go on.
Could you switch hats for a second to your poet hat?
Yeah.
And talk about how you, as a poet, seek to give local habitation to airy nothings in view of all the things that you've been talking about.
Wow, right. Well, I think one of the... in the course of writing a poem, I mean, obviously you write a lot of things which you hoped would be poems, but turn out not to be poems. They're sort of stillborn or they, you know. But one of the things that makes you know that what you're working on is possibly a poem is the sense when it quickens and kicks and pushes back against what you thought you were going to write. That the poem knows what its body should be. It knows more about its name than you do. And it starts telling you how to write it. And it may not have been your original plan A. And, you know, I can remember when I wrote the poem at the beginning of my sequence on the sayings of Jesus, which was the he who has ears to hear, let him hear. But I was trying to talk about the idea of opening up the scriptures. And at the beginning of the poem, it was all about how do I remove the film of familiarity from these sayings of Jesus? How do I unwrap them? How do I kind of take them out of the sort of the cerements of familiarity and let them be fresh? That was the poem I thought I was going to write. And that's the poem I started writing. And then in the middle of the poem, it turned around and said, no, no. And it produced, unbidden, the image of Jesus saying to Lazarus, come forth, and then saying, unbind him. And by the end of the poem, I realized what hollow arrogance it was to have thought that I was going to unwrap scripture. It's scripture that, so in the end of it, I'm saying to Jesus, unloose me, untie me, take all these bandages and wrappings off me, and let me be exposed. And scripture becomes the two-edged sword that it was meant to be. So the poem knew more than I did about what it needed to be. And that's, I think, where the language of bodying forth is really important, because a body in this case is a living thing. It's not a corpse, it's a living, moving, growing body that pushes and wants to grow into its own shape. And that's very exciting when you're writing, when the poem quickens as you're writing it. And then you have to start listening to the poem as well as to what you thought the poem was going to be. And that way you learn from it. That way you write a poem which knows more than you do. And that's the real joy of writing. And that's why, to go back to the question, I think the Narnia stories knew more about Jesus than Lewis himself knew at the time of his writing, and he was learning from them too as he was writing them. Maybe since you've asked me to write in poet mode, I could just close with a poem I meant to end with, but I ran out of time, which is just called C.S. Lewis. The only thing you need to know really about this poem is that when Lewis... You had to teach at Oxford as a tutor all the subjects within language and literature. People went to the specialist lectures, but your director of studies was supposed to give you everything. So Lewis, although Tolkien was the great Anglo-Saxon specialist, Lewis nevertheless taught Anglo-Saxon. But he didn't call it Anglo-Saxon 101, the vowel shift. He called it Beer and Beowulf. And he had a jug of beer there and gave his tutees, you know, to drink. And then they read Beowulf together. So that I allude to that at the beginning of this. So C.S. Lewis... From Beer and Beowulf to the seven heavens, whose music you conduct from sphere to sphere. You are our portal to those hidden havens whence we return to bless our being here. Scribe of the kingdom, keeper of the door which opens unto all we might have lost, ward of a word hoard in the deep heart's core, telling the tale of love from first to last. generous, capacious, open, free. Your wardrobe mind has furnished us with worlds through which to travel, whence we learn to see along the beam and hear at last the heralds sounding their summons through the stars that sing, whose call at sunrise brings us to our king. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. We were hearing there from the Reverend Dr. Malcolm Guite. He gave that presentation at a C.S. Lewis symposium called Now We Have Faces. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources and podcasts. And do register there for the chance to win a free book. That's premierunbelievable.com. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating it and reviewing it on your podcast platform. Thank you for listening and see you next time.